Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips of the PC. It is Saturday, the 28th of January, Anno Domini 2017. And you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, and nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes, don't get the blues. Here comes the news. For the sixth year in a row, password management security company Splash Data has scraped password dumps and scoured through the data to find the world's most common passwords. This year, they had a couple of billion to choose from. This year's compilation was drawn from over 5 million leaked emails. That's a lie, of course, because there were 2 billion of them just in the, who was it?
Yahoo.
The passwords, Yahoo. Right. The passwords were mostly held by users in North America and Western Europe. Splash Data estimates that just over 10% of people use at least one of the 25 passwords on this year's list, up from 3% in 2014. A whopping 4% use the worst password, 123456. That's funny. That's the same password I have on my luggage.
Yeah.
And the list also includes multiple variations of password, meaning that John Podesta wasn't alone. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and password topped the list, just as they did in 2014 and 2015. All but one of the numeric patterns was in last year's top 25 often repeated passwords, including 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 7, and 1, 2, 3, 4.
It's kind of interesting to see the password length requirements increasing on websites. And the stupidity of the passwords also increasing.
Right. Right. New this year was 121212. This year's list included password and the variations, password with a zero, and the new but predictable password one. It also had some pretty obvious words, QWERTY, login, welcome, admin. That was another new one this year. Old favorites include football, princess, solo, ABC123, dragon, and master. Other new words this year, hottie, love me, sunshine, flower. Oh, and ZAQ1, 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 which you get when you type up the left column on a standard QWERTY keyboard. Yes, other people can figure that out. The new passwords replace 2015's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Baseball, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, QAZ, 2, WSX. Again, if you go down the keyboard on the right there,
which
on the left.
Which at first glance looks random.
Looks random and clearly
not.
Is not.
Yeah.
Monkey, Let Me In, QWERTY UEOP, and Star Wars. Many people wrongly assume that adding a zero instead of an O will make their password more secure. But that's not the case. Making minor modifications to an easily guessed password does not make it secure, and hackers will take advantage of these tendencies. Your best bet is the same as ever. Create complex password phrases and use a unique password for every account. That's because reusing passwords on multiple accounts leaves all of your accounts vulnerable. If just one gets hacked and the password gets dumped. To make things easier, store your passwords in a password manager. How many years have we been saying this stuff? If you're going to ignore password best practices, one way to be a little more secure is to set up two-factor authentication, at least on your email account. Two-factor authentication is a way to keep you safe from someone nefariously trying to reset your password. It adds an extra layer of security by asking for a second factor in addition to username and password to prove your identity. If someone tries to reset your password and you have two-factor authentication enabled, it'll be much harder for them to gain access to your account. And if you have two-factor authentication on your email account, this would at least stop a malicious actor from being able to reset all your other passwords unless they can crack them, of course. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is your password on the list of the world's worst? The choices are, I'm ashamed to say, but yes, I'm ashamed to say, so I won't, not exactly, And nope. So far, we've got 27 votes. 89% of you said nope. Statistically speaking, 10% of you are lying. And the rest all said not exactly. Now, I know you're going to have a lot more to say about this, particularly about how annoying it is to have passwords in the first place. Get over yourself. So if you scroll down on the right under on our website, if you scroll down at the right under Fascinating Stuff, the first link is the forums. The second forum down is the poll discussion. And so far, at least, the first poll discussion, the first topic in the list is 28 Jan 17. 2016's worst password are just as bad as 2015. Four people have left five posts, and we'd love to have you join us there. And, of course, you can join us on the phone, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
That number in Bayonne is...
Yeah, exactly. We've been saying this forever, and every year they put out this list, and every year it's the same stupid passwords. And, you know, everybody says, well, I'm not important. Well, that's your assessment of yourself. And if you have it, then it's probably true. But you're still important to hackers because you have email accounts they can use to send out bad stuff. You have access to files that they would love to be able to put bad stuff on. You have social media accounts that they would love to hack and send out bad stuff. You have a bank account, at least one, that they would love to get their hands on and run up your credit. And if you don't care about that, then 123456 7 is a great password. But if you do care about that, maybe you should pay a little more attention to your password. You think, well, they're all state actors, so they're going after states. A lot of them are individuals, and they will take any target of opportunity they can. And if your password is one of the crap ones on this list, then you are a target of opportunity. It is that simple.
Even just to be a level of anonymity for the bad guy. You know, I can attack somebody else using your name, and then the police will arrest you, not me.
Right. What if somebody hacks your Twitter account and starts typing, let's kill Donald Trump?
Yep.
I suspect somebody's going to want to come and talk to you about that. And you then have to prove it wasn't you. And I suspect the level of the burden of proof is high in that particular case. So protect your passwords, protect your systems, because these things, they're not targeting you. They're targeting everybody. It's all automated. So if you're using one of those passwords, once they get to you, they hack you.
And it might not even be on your computer. They get into your email account. Well, that's not on your computer. So they can read all of your email. They can go to, say Amazon, and I forgot my password, and then reset it from your email and then run up your bill.
Right, right. And so all of these things are doable. All of these things are happening today. And you are just as vulnerable as everybody else. Don't be smug and hide behind your anonymity, because in terms of computers, you don't have any. All right, to the phones. Our first caller is Larry from Rochester, New York. What's up, Larry?
Good afternoon, guys. I thought I would get my licks in early this morning.
Or okay.
This afternoon. Tell you what I did. I decided to try an online backup service. I chose iDrive. Chose it 48 hours ago, and looking at it right now, it's at 22%. That's
yep.
All it's upgraded so far out of 40.1 gigabytes that it's supposed to upload. I honestly, after looking at PC Mag as its editor's choice, I don't see how they could possibly do that. And I know you can't fix this. I guess I'm just griping.
Yep.
But the only thing that allows me to sleep now is I got it at bargain basement price, and I suspect that's why it was bargain basement. But when it was compared to the other services, I find it incredible that it could have these upload speeds like 500 kilobytes per second or something so ridiculous. At this rate, it'll be next month by the time it gets a complete upgrade of my hard drive. So I guess that's all I had to say. I'm just incredulous that this thing could be at the top of the list, and it makes me wonder what is online backup service really like when it comes to backing up your drive.
Well, let's put your mind at ease, Larry.
Yeah, it's nothing to do with iDrive.
Right.
It's everything to do with your internet service. Typically, internet services are what we call asymmetric. You might get 10 megabit down because you're downloading websites.
Right.
You might only get 1 megabit up because the only thing most people generally upload is a little tiny URL, gmail.com. So that doesn't have to have a big pipe. More and more people are now doing online backup. And so if you're getting 500K, that's really good for a 1 megabit upload.
And so when you have any, you could be doing any online backup and you would have the same issue because it's not the online backup. I do online backup, but I'm on Greenlight and I get 20 megabits up, which is more, I believe, than you get down. So my backups are very fast.
But even that first backup, you said you're backing up 40 gigs.
Right.
Taking a week to upload 40 gigs would be common. Because upload speeds are generally so much slower than download. There are some services where you can buy faster upload, and generally that costs a lot more. In fact, faster download is usually cheaper than faster upload.
Yep.
Am I allowed to say my service?
Well, you don't have to.
Okay.
But you could check with them to see if they offer a faster upload speed, what the price is, and if you want to pay that or not.
Okay.
Right, but so what you have to remember...
This is typical.
This is not only typical, but it's across the industry, not just in our area, but everywhere. Unless you have a very high-speed connection that does very high-speed upload, this is what you're going to get. Now, the thing to remember is that depending on what software you're using to do your upload, once you have that 40 gig on iDrive, the next upload will only be new or changed files and will therefore happen much faster.
Now, when you say what software, I'm using whatever I got from iDrive when I, signed up for the service. I guess I don't know what you mean when you say what software I'm using.
The software from the company, so in your case, the iDrive software,
right,
should have what's called an incremental upgrade, and we are
or incremental backup.
Incremental backup. We're checking to make sure. Okay. Virtually all of them would, because when you change a file, it gets updated. It doesn't have to upload everything again, just the changed files.
Oh, okay.
And that should be common on all of the backup services. We're looking through the iDrive feature list.
Right. Do you know which product you're using? Because they have mobile, Facebook, Instagram, Linux, hybrid, iDrive Smart Docs, iDrive Near Line, iDrive One. So I don't know which one you're using, and I haven't got time to look them all up. But basically, if you have, if it allows for, and you can read through the docs for it.
Okay.
And basically what you're hoping to see is the words maybe incremental or only new, only changed, actually only new or changed files, that sort of fare. So this first update will take a while.
Okay, so this one is the version I have is supposed to, when it checks again, it only does what's changed.
There you go. Then
which
you
is,
win.
Which is
common. And changed also means new, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Right, so because that's a change from not being there to being there.
Okay, so while I have my pencil in my hand, then basically, once again, what do I do to get better upload service?
Call your internet provider and ask them if they offer faster upload speeds and what the price is.
Because they will charge you for that.
Okay. No free lunch.
Ain't no such thing as a free lunch. Ten stoffel.
Or you just let it run and don't worry about it. There are some services, I don't know if iDrive is one of them, where some services where you back up to a hard drive and then you send them the hard drive and that's your first backup. to them. So it's a lot faster than uploading everything over the internet.
So iDrive does offer that, and they offer that as one of their perks against some of the other services, though some of the other services may be doing it also now. But when I saw that, I said, well, why bother? I'm just going to upload this thing just like I'd move something to iCloud or move it to Google Drive.
Yep.
You know, what's the need until I started looking at this thing? And 2 days later, it's just sitting here just kind of
FedEx is faster
along.
Than the internet.
Right, right. Well, and this is the thing you have to remember. It's the scale that's the problem. When you upload a 4 meg file, it takes a few seconds.
Right.
When you upload 40 gigs of data, you know, do the math, that's 1,000 times bigger.
Okay.
All right, so we gotta take a break.
All right, well, thank you so much, and I'll be listening to the rest of the program.
All right, thanks, Larry. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 20 minutes after the hour. It's Sound Bites on the truly great and solely member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, I can't get my glasses on with the headset on. All right, hold on. Here we go.
And I'm still waiting for Dave before I say my name.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Chris from Greece, New York. Hiya, Chris. What's up?
Oh, question. Another question on security. This one on VPNs. I just received iDrop news that said, you know, even your iPhones and everything should have a VPN. But when I look it up, it's like, well, that's if you go to Hulu or Netflix or HBO or Amazon. My concern is if I do a VPN, does that mean that's where I have to get my Dropbox and my iCloud and my mail to be secure?
Well, if you do a VPN, then everything you do goes through that VPN, yes. The thing about VPNs is they're like everything else on the internet. Who do you trust?
Exactly.
Because you've got to have somebody at the other end set up your VPN. So the question is, who do you trust to send all of your data through?
And that's the thing. A lot of these are lifetime subscriptions, so that also brings up kind of a red flag to me. It's like I'm home.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I talked to all these people who do VPNs and Tor and all this other stuff, and I say, who are you going through? Oh, it's some server in China. Okay, that's probably not actually secure. So the basic idea here is, for those of you who don't know what a VPN is, it's a virtual private network. It's essentially a tunnel through the internet. You're not mingling your data with the riffraff. You have a private pipe through the internet. And as Chris has said, it's very private. It's very secure from people eavesdropping over the internet. But at some point, all of your data go through a server at the VPN site. So how much do you trust whoever that is who's providing the VPN?
And the one thing it can do for you is hide your location. So you subscribe to a VPN service that exits in say Dallas, and now anyone looking at your traffic thinks you're in Dallas. So instead of trying to attack you locally, they'll attack the Dallas point. So when your traffic leaves the VPN and heads onto the public internet, it can still be sniffed there, and that's part of the problem. That there are agencies that sniff the entire internet. And we'll still be able to find you.
Right. Where VPNs are actually useful is if your company sets one up. Then you log into your VPN to do work in your company. Now, everything inside the company is, of course, protected, and your connection from outside the company is protected. So all of their intellectual property and all of that stuff are protected.
It's as if you were sitting in the company yourself, but you're at your home computer.
Right. But when you use a VPN to go on the public internet, at some point, all of that information is publicly available, no matter who your VPN is.
Got it. So if I'm just on Wi-Fi, and let's say I'm not home, I'm at some other Wi-Fi hookup, they could actually, if somebody really wanted to, see my email, get on my Dropbox, go in my iCloud, they could do all that stuff?
Well, yes and no. Again, it depends on how your system is set up. If, for example, you are using HTTPS to get to everything, so it's a secure connection. Now we have to worry about the other end. How good is their encryption? Most of the big players, Apple, Microsoft, Google, have very high-end encryption, very hard to break. Someone probably could break it sometime in the next, say, 100 years.
So that's really not on my end, on their end. But I'm thinking like my email just automatically gets downloaded to my phone. So is there a way that I should be safeguarding that?
Well, in terms of, there's a great question.
In terms of email, think of email like a postcard. Anyone can read it along the way if they wanted to.
Right.
They probably won't, but they can. Email was never designed to be secure. There are ways to try to make email secure, but they don't work well because email isn't designed to be secure.
Right. Now, most providers today use secure connections to get your email to you. So again, if you're with one of the major players like Gmail or Apple's Mail or Microsoft Outlook or whichever one they're calling it this week, you are secure in the transmission of your data. Once it reaches your device, whether that's your phone or your laptop or whatever, all bets are off. It's how protected that is.
And between mail servers, it may not be encrypted either.
Right.
So if you send a message from Google to Yahoo, between Google and Yahoo, it may not be encrypted. In fact, that was one of the big Snowden revelations, is that the NSA was tapping Google, and everything leaving Google when it hit the public internet was being read because it was no longer encrypted.
Right. So if you send Google to Google, it was secure.
It will stay encrypted, yeah.
But if you sent Google to Yahoo or Yahoo to Google, it could be read in transit.
So when you're setting up your device, your phone, your computer, whatever, in the email program, you want to make sure you turn on something called SSL, or in some cases, it'll be called TLS, which is actually correct. If I ran into that with Google, we couldn't just turn on SSL. It had to say TLS.
Right.
And that will encrypt the data between you and Google. And so that's about the best you can do, is encrypt it between you and Google. If you are trying to send a secure message, a secure email, that you don't want anyone else to be able to intercept, you need to encrypt it on your computer before it leaves your computer. Now, we sometimes call that PI, pre-internet encryption.
Right.
Encrypt it yourself with an encryption program, send the encrypted file to the other end. Then the problem is, how do you get the password to the other end over some secure communication? And so you have to meet them in a middle of an empty field, put bags over your head so no one can read your lips, and tell them what the password is. So that's why we say email is not secure. Do not count on email being private. Anyone can read your email along the way if
right.
they want
to. Right. Now, that being said, there are programs like ProtonMail.
Yeah.
That is a free encrypted email system. But you and the other person must both be using ProtonMail. Tutanota does it as well, but I don't know them at all. But ProtonMail, for example, does completely secure end-to-end. Setting it up is not easy. Everybody has to be on the same program, so both you and the other end must be using ProtonMail. There's a thing called Secure Gmail that does the same thing. Again, both you and the other person must be using Secure Gmail. So You can easily set these, well, easily, you can set these things up, but doing so is not actually terribly easy, and both ends have to be using it. Thunderbird had an encryption add-in that you could use, but again, when you sent it to somebody, they had to have it as well.
Yeah, you can add PGP encryption to your email, but the other end also has to have that, and you have to meet face-to-face to exchange keys, for example. So there are ways to do secure mail. It's just very difficult, and both ends have to be on the same system.
So I read something that somebody's bank wouldn't even work because the VPN was on. But my thought is, I don't usually do any banking. I might look at my account, but I don't actually do anything. As long as I'm in that HTTPS, I'm good.
Well, you're pretty good. You're about 90% good. You know, I mean, certainly you're secure against about 90% of the bad guys out there. It would have to be somebody with access to a very high-end decrypting system and a willingness to go for your stuff. And as we said earlier to Larry, everybody is vulnerable in the sense that they'll go after everybody. But again, particularly with something like email, if it's encrypted, they'll set it aside and continue to look for the unencrypted email, because those are targets of opportunity, right? They're low-hanging fruit.
The thing that kind of confused me was when I went to these VPNs, they were touting that this would be good for if you had HBO or Hulu or Netflix. And what is that? Just so that they would, somebody can get your account number? Is that it?
No, what they're for now, that's a whole other story.
Yeah, and so you can violate the terms of service.
Right.
And you can watch, say, BBC television shows in America that are currently restricted to watching it in the UK.
So if you use a VPN that's in the UK, Netflix thinks you're in the UK and will show you movies and TV shows that are not available to Americans.
Oh, okay.
Right. But that is, by the way, illegal.
But they can't come right out and say that.
Right. But that would be illegal. And there are people using programs like Kodi, which will let you get all kinds of illegal streams, television, movies, everything.
But it does legal stuff too, which is the confusion.
Right, and Kodi is fine as a program, but people use it for illegal things. And when they do use it for illegal things, they often set up a VPN so that it is more difficult to catch them.
Got it. Well, thanks, guys. You've led me on the right path again, so appreciate the info. Have a good day.
Yeah. Have fun, Chris.
We also often see political dissidents using VPNs
yes.
to hide where they are so the government can't come and arrest them.
Right. There are extremely wonderful reasons to use VPNs. There are also some nefarious reasons.
Yep. Yeah, the most common reason to use a VPN is so you can work from home. So you have a VPN into your office, and the office network thinks your computer is there. You can get to the office printers, the office file servers, and everything is encrypted over the public internet. That's sort of the most common use of VPNs for legitimate purposes.
Right. The other part of this issue is because encryption, and it is, of course, National Data Privacy Day today, so it's good that we're talking about this stuff. Once the, let's say email, data of any sort, but we're talking about emails specifically right now. Once an email hits your phone, it's unencrypted. So it doesn't matter, you know, if somebody wants to steal your information, frankly, the easiest way to get it is to steal your phone. And, of course, there's all kinds of lawsuits right now about cracking phones and not cracking phones and who can do it and who can't and can Apple help and can Google help and yada, yada, yada. But the bottom line is that this device that you hold in your hand has more information about you than you think it does. So it not only has all of your email and probably 80% of your passwords, but it knows where you've been, when you were there, how long you were there, who you've called on the phone, the private numbers of everybody you know. this is a device that is has intruded itself, and I use that word advisedly, into every single private corner of our lives, and we just carry them around and leave them on buses and drop them in down sewer grates, and we don't care. Yeah.
There's an interesting and somewhat scary practice happening. Police officers in the UK now, and it's spreading around the world, will mug a suspect to grab their phone before it locks. So say you're on a phone call, you've unlocked your phone to take the phone call, and most phones will lock again after a couple of minutes, and then you need the fingerprint or the passcode. And so the police need a warrant for that. But if they can grab your phone before it locks and then keep doing stuff to prevent it from locking again, then they don't need a warrant for your fingerprint.
Right.
And so police are now starting to mug their suspects to grab the phone. So they're following the suspect around, waiting for them to answer a call, and then grab the phone while it's unlocked, and then they can read all the data on it.
Yep. And there has been, for many, many years, there's been a practice of, what do they call it, apple picking? People standing on a corner talking on their phone. Some kid comes by on a skateboard, grabs the phone out of your hand, boom, he's gone. Even locked, even closed, even turned off, it can be sold for $50.
Yep.
And so, you know, that's those are, and that's true of anybody's phone. So many people don't lock their phones because it's an inconvenience to have to unlock it.
And even with the fingerprint readers, now that you don't have to remember a real long password, you can just use your fingerprint.
Right.
The laws basically say you can be compelled to turn over your fingerprint.
Well, none of us are lawyers, and I don't even play one on television anymore, but from what I understood the last time I looked, which was 6 months ago, so who knows, you could be compelled to give them your password.
No, password is
the other way around.
Right, password is something you know. That's Fifth Amendment protection.
That's Fifth Amendment protection, but your fingerprint is not a Fifth Amendment protection.
So like your DNA, they can be compelled to take DNA from you.
Right.
And so your fingerprint, they can be compelled to get your fingerprint.
Right.
Now, Apple has combated this somewhat with their activation lock. So if you have the activation lock turned on, basically meaning signing into your iCloud account, if someone steals your phone, they cannot use it without your iCloud password. So if they try to resell it, and this happens in our store all the time, someone will buy a phone or iPad on eBay. It's got someone else's password on it, and they say, "Well, can you break that?" And we say, "No, we can't. That's the whole point of it."
Yeah, right.
To prevent someone from stealing it, and I'm sure Android does something similar.
Yes. All right, we are going to take another break. We will be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 40 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It is Sound Bites on the Truly Great. And truly grateful to be member supported, Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member supported, Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Wright.
And I'm Michael Oden.
I almost said I'm David Wright. Dave, come back.
And in 44 minutes after the hour, you're listening to sound bites, I suppose. We don't know. It's Identity Crisis Radio. We don't know who we are.
I just found an interesting article, Fingerprints and the Law, it's a government website. I was looking at the acronym, NCJRS. Let me see what NCJRS is.
J for Justice, National.
Probably. Social. National Criminal Justice Reference Service. And so they have this big PDF on fingerprints and the law and what you can do legally with a fingerprint. So it's written for lawyers, but it'd be interesting for average people to read and figure out, you know, what you might want to do. So one of the things we've heard is, if, you know, when the police come and raid your house, turn your phone off, because then the fingerprint doesn't work and it needs your passcode.
Right.
So if you have enough time, turn your phone off.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you posting this?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. All right, we're back to the phones. Our next caller is Gary from Greece, New York. What's up, Gary?
Hi, guys.
What can we do for you?
I got a question about Yahoo Mail.
Yeah.
And their connection with Frontier Mail. Is it dangerous to have both? I mean, I know Yahoo's got a lot of problems about security and all that.
Yeah.
How does that work out for Frontier?
I don't know specifically if you're still using the Frontier email address and the Frontier servers, then your mail is probably only going through Frontier. But Yahoo is hosting the back end of Frontier Mail. So even if you're using pop3.frontier.com, your mail might be physically stored on a Yahoo server that was compromised. It's one of the reasons they don't use your internet service provider's email. Get a different email service like Gmail or Yahoo. Now we're saying don't get Yahoo because they apparently don't take security very well. Or just understand the fact that anyone can read your mail anytime they want. But the danger there, as we talked about earlier, is all these is recovery email addresses. So you forget your Amazon password, so they email you. You forget your PayPal password, they email you. You forget your Citibank password, they email you. So if someone gets in your email, they can do a lot of damage to you.
Now, two things that that I do fairly regularly. One is I have multiple. I use Gmail more often than I use anything else. I have multiple Gmail accounts. Because I have one specifically when I'm signing up for, you know, I want to download a white paper. Well, they want you to sign up, so I sign up on a separate account, and then I have a filter that throws away everything that comes to that account, everything, because I don't care. So you can have multiple accounts. You can open up multiple accounts. So that you don't have to use your main account for password restore, right? So even if somebody steals your main account information, they haven't got those other accounts. The other thing is, on December 14th of last year, 2016, Yahoo did send out a security notice that said they fixed everything. It's all great now. Congratulations. We're good. So take that with as many grains of salt as you need to.
Ooh.
But I'm not going to say they're completely unsecured or insecure, because they have taken steps, and we know that.
I've called Frontier and they tell me, don't worry about it.
Well, yeah, of course.
Secure.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what to tell you. Again, if you go back to things like secured email, there's a thing called, I want to say it's Streak. Hold on. Gmail Streak, I think, is what it's called. Yeah. It's a secure connection to Google Apps. So that might not work for everybody. But there are secure Gmail is another product. And I'm sure that there are similar add-ons for things like Yahoo and stuff, so that you can have secured email, which is important, I think. What would be best is if everybody's email was encrypted at their machines, whether that's your desktop or your laptop or your phone or whatever, and then decrypted at the other person's machine. That would be best, but that requires everybody to be using the same encryption program, or everybody to have available to them multiple encryption programs. And then, as Steve said, how do we get the keys to everybody? You can use public key encryption. That's not as easy as it sounds, but it is probably the best solution, et cetera, et cetera. So there's just a lot right now. There's no workably easy solution that I've found that works easily for everybody.
All right.
Okie doke.
Yep. Unfortunately, that's kind of where we are now.
Right. So, for example, in Gmail, you can in Gmail, you can when you're composing an email, you can right click it and say encrypt the email. Well, great.
But only on the Gmail website.
But only the Gmail website, yeah. And then the other person has to have the password. So at some point, you have to send that person the password. Now,
on a different channel. If you email them the password,
that's bad.
Then the same guy that reads the encrypted message will be able to read the password message.
Right, because the password message has to be unencrypted, because otherwise, so you get that. So, for example, Steve and I are in the same studio right now. So I could say, Steve, let's send encrypted email to each other. The password is happy34monkey. Okay. except for the fact that I actually said that over the public airwaves, that's a secure way of transmitting the password to the other person, assuming Steve remembers that the password is happy 32 monkey 34. Wait, was it 32? Was it 34?
So I'll put it on a post-it note stuck on my screen,
right,
and then someone looking over my shoulder can see it.
See, it already works. Nobody remembers it, so nobody can get in.
Right, it's very secure. But the other part of that problem, of course, then becomes it's all human run, and that means it's prone to human error. I have to type in the password correctly. Steve has to remember the password correctly. He has to type in the password correctly. So if you can automate it, and again, there are programs that do the automation, but none of them are super plug-in, simple, easy ways to do it yet. We're hoping to see that. I would love to see public key encryption available to everybody in every email program ever. And of course, there's the second part of the problem. If I want to send out an encrypted email to Steve and Michael, and Michael's on Yahoo Mail, I don't mean to insult you, Michael, but if Michael's on Yahoo Mail, now I cannot send it because there's no mechanism to unencrypt Gmail encryption in Yahoo. So now I've got a separate set of problems, which is now I either have to find some encryption algorithm that works with Yahoo and with Gmail, or two separate encryption algorithms, which now means I'm sending the message twice. It just becomes a nightmare. The industry really has to get together and say, this is what we're going to do. Now, there are there have already been a couple of meetings about that, and as you can imagine, they went so smoothly. But we'll see what the future brings for that.
And the problem there is the same thing that happens on websites. I posted a link to a plugin called HTTPS Everywhere that will tell your web browser to always use HTTPS if it. Many servers are now encrypting at the other end, even though you know they're not handling money or passwords. They don't technically need to encrypt, but just encryption is good. And in fact, Google Chrome and some of the other browsers are now shaming websites for not being encrypted.
Right.
So what can happen is a multi-tiered attack. So you get some piece of software in your computer, probably through a phishing email, that then tells the web server, "Oh, I don't support encryption." And the web server says, okay, here's the unencrypted page. Because the web and email were never encrypted from the beginning, to maintain backward compatibility, a lot of these places, a lot of servers, will downgrade to no encryption or to weak encryption for that backward compatibility. And it's becoming more of a social experiment where they don't need to crack your email. They just call you up. Hi, this is Bill from Microsoft. There's a problem. We need your password.
Right.
And enough people say, here you go, that they don't have to worry about breaking into your password.
Right. And a lot of people will say, well, why didn't they bother? What kind of idiots put together the internet without bothering about security? Well, back in the day, of course, the internet was for the Department of Defense. It was the original internet was a dozen or so Department of Defense agencies around the country and a few institutes of higher education that were doing Department of Defense work.
And everyone's generally pretty honest.
And those people were vetted within an inch of their lives, so everybody knew.
To the point that the internet literally had an address book.
Yes.
Where you could actually find somebody's.
Yes, those address books are still out there. You can find them.
GRC just posted a couple of the early pictures. Every computer on the internet, there were 13 of them.
Yeah, exactly. And everybody knew who everybody was. So if somebody did something bad, everybody knew who that person was. And nobody wanted to lose that sweet, sweet government money. So nobody did any of the bad stuff.
Back when the internet was like a small town.
Right. And it was only when we let the riffraff in. We had a meeting many, many, many decades ago about this. And one of the people, I wish I still had mine, to hand out t-shirts that said, "The internet is full, go away."
Yep.
You know, it was a meeting we had to determine whether or not we would let in the riffraff.
Yep. So I'll post this in a moment, but I found a picture May 1973, every computer on the internet, it's a nice grid. There's lines connecting, you know, different companies. You can see where NASA Ames is, you know, Stanford University. And that was 1973. By 1977, the next picture they had, it gets a little bit more complicated.
A little bit, but not by much.
But not by much, yep.
And now, so there's a couple of
remote,
like,
yeah, there's a couple of remote links. That's probably a satellite link to, yep, you know, UK maybe.
Yep. And then if you look at it today, it looks like a picture of a constellation with billions of stars.
Yep. Yeah.
So yeah, that basic connection to the internet. Same thing with email. The miracle was being able to send email. Nobody thought about encryption because the whole idea was the open exchange of ideas.
Yeah.
You know, the open exchange of ideas.
And that was the hope of the internet is the democratization, forgive my pronunciation, of the internet would let everyone have a voice.
Right.
The problem is the idiots have as big a voice as the smarts.
Right, right.
And
right.
Unfortunately, they have a louder voice.
Well, right. And we're seeing that now. The feedback.
Mostly, most times in all caps.
Yeah.
Well, yes, yes, yes. And we're also seeing the phenomenon of the feedback, right? If you have a certain mindset, whether it be political or social or moral or whatever, you can find 100 billion people on the internet with that exact same mindset. And so it becomes your world. You don't hear the opposing viewpoints. You know, back in the day when we got most of our information from radio and television, we had equal time, right? Yeah. There was an actual law that if I had a neoconservative on, I had to have a liberal on as well at some point to give them equal time. And so people heard both sides of an argument. Nowadays, they don't even hear it. And that's part of what's causing the polarization of our world.
I heard saw a good one, Bill Nye, the science guy.
Bill.
And that was 30 years ago, you know?
Yeah.
Something like that.
I don't care.
He did a thing about the climate change issue.
Yeah.
And typically the numbers you hear is 95% of all scientists believe humans are causing climate change.
Right.
And whenever they debate it on TV, it's one guy for and one guy against.
Right.
Well, that's not fair. So he did a panel where he had 95 guys for and five guys against. That's what the argument really looks like.
Yep, yep, yep.
And then there was the George Takei law? Issue. Back in the, was it the 80s? George Takei ran for city council.
Right.
George Takei from Star Trek.
Right.
And
Mr. Sulu, for those of you who don't know.
And there were like 20 people running on the ballot in California, because that's what California is. And several of them demanded an hour of free television time because Star Trek was on showing Mr. Sulu.
Right.
And they said, well, you know, our opponent's on TV. We need to be on TV. So the station had to stop running Sulu episodes.
Yes.
During politics season because, you know, 20 hours a day would be the political commentary.
When Schwarzenegger was running for governor of California, they had to not run any of his movies on the local television.
Yeah.
Now, that didn't mean you couldn't still get them in on Netflix or you know, whatever, but local television couldn't run them.
Yeah.
All right, that music tells me we seem to, for some reason, be done for an hour, for the first hour. We'll be back in just a few minutes with a whole nother hour of this nonsense. So you are perfectly free to give us a call, 585-966-5299 or 1-800-790-0415. And we will listen to any and all viewpoints, unless you're a complete idiot, and then we'll just hang up. But other than that, we will be glad to come back for a whole nother hour of sound bites with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 1 o'clock. And we'll be back in with more sound bites in just a few minutes. Stay tuned.
Never seen the Grace Hopper.
Computer talk you can understand. More sound bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Grease Rochester, a public service of the Grease Central School District, Jazz 90.1.
On Twitter at 901 Jazz.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, you're hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It is Soundbites. It is member-supported Jazz 90.1, and it is Mike from Caledonia on the line. Hi, Mike. What's up?
Oh, hi. How are you doing, guys?
Good. How are you?
I've got about a 10-year-old HP laptop that has 2 gig of RAM, 64-bit, and it's been running really slow.
Yeah.
I'm running Ubuntu on it. I've been running it since I first got the machine, basically. And I've tried different versions, but it's really, really running slow now. And I tried to put Neverware on it, and it says it won't accept it for some reason. So I downloaded Lubuntu on a disk and did a memory check, and I've got like 600 memory errors.
Yeah.
Does that mean I need to replace my memory?
Yep. Okay. There's no magic. Once a hardware component goes bad, you're kind of done. I would also do a hard drive check. And
I
see,
did that.
And that came out okay?
That came out okay.
Yeah, then it is the memory, and that will certainly cause extreme slowdowns. And okay, the only fix for that is replacing the memory.
Because every time there's a memory error, it has to go back and reread that chunk of memory again.
Gotcha. Okay, now there's 2 1-gigabyte chips. Should I take one out and do the memory test again to find out which one is bad, or are they? Well, I assume they're both bad.
Well, that's a lovely question. It certainly can't hurt to test each one individually.
Okay.
And that, of course, assumes what motherboard you have. Some of them require paired memory, so taking one out means it won't boot at all.
Yeah, no, this was running with only 1 gig for a while, and then eventually I bought another gig and I added it to it.
Yeah, all right, then. Test the older one first. But okay. Well, you're going to test both of them anyway, so it doesn't much matter.
Right.
But yeah, so it is very possible that that's the issue. And then good luck finding a 1 gig memory stick these days.
Yeah, if the motherboard will take more, you put in 2 2s or 2 4s.
Right. Yeah, no, it won't. 2 gig is the max.
Ah.
Right.
And is there,
remember when that was a lot?
Take Neverware?
Sorry?
You know why it wouldn't let me download the where?
Well, probably there was an error message that told you a lot, but it probably has a lot to do with the fact that the memory is bad.
It said that it wasn't accepted on this machine. That was the message I got. And then I looked up, and I couldn't. They have a site that says accepted machines, and my computer wasn't on that site.
Well, there you go. That's the issue. One of the problems is that your laptop is, in fact, 10 years old.
Right.
And just nobody supporting something that's that old. Ubuntu itself will likely run because they just keeping on, right? But when you start with a brand new product like Neverware, they tend to not go back 10 years for their support.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Good luck.
Thanks a lot.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, have fun. What I wanted to do, and I'm not a hardware guy, so I don't know how to do this myself or if it's even feasible. But we've talked about this. Take an old laptop,
mm-hmm.
pull out the motherboard, and replace it with like a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
And then hook it to all the components that are already in there. And now you've got a much more modern motherboard that costs you a total of maybe $50 if you buy everything. It's all connected in there. It should fit in there without any issues. And now you've got essentially a newish laptop. Still got the old screen.
You may have to be handy with a Dremel and a soldering iron to wire the ports up.
Right, right.
Which is probably why it isn't done.
Right.
There's probably somebody making a pre-built, Raspberry Pi. Just plug a portable monitor in.
Yeah,
Raspberry Pi in a box.
Well, you can get that. You can absolutely get Raspberry Pi in a box. I'm saying put a Raspberry Pi in your old laptop is what I was looking at.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going back to the phones. Our next caller is that Rob from Arundhati, New York. Hi, Rob. What's up?
No, it's Bob from Brian DeQuay.
Oh, sorry, Bob.
That's okay. I hope you three Mouskiners can solve my little problem here.
That depends on your problem, doesn't it?
It's not a big one. I was fiddling around in settings and control panel in the personalization area, and I screwed up my desktop. And I'll tell you four characteristics that I see right now, and maybe you can help me out of that. If I take my cursor all the way to the right border, I see a scroll bar there, and normally a desktop wouldn't have a scroll bar. And
what version of Windows are you running?
Windows 10.
Okay.
Probably turned on Zoom.
Yeah.
Turned on Zoom.
There's a way to do a zoom in, so your 13-inch monitor looks like a 20-inch monitor, so you just see a little piece of it.
Uh-huh.
And then when you get to the edges, you scroll around to see the rest of that virtual monitor.
I'll check that out. The second thing is, when all my desktop icons are gone, including the trash bin and all that, the third thing is, normally when you right-click on the cursor on your desktop, you get a menu. And if you click View, you get a submenu. You could go all the way down and check or uncheck View All Icons.
Right.
Well, when I right-click on the desktop, there is no menu, so that's gone. The last thing characteristic is all the tiles that you normally see in the startup button when you left-click are now permanently in front of me on my present so-called desktop, and I can't seem to get those tiles unhidden back to where they were before.
Yeah, so, the tiles is its own layer, and you have to go to the desktop as a different layer. It sounds like for some reason you're not getting to the desktop at all. You're just stuck on the tiles. The zooming option, the Windows magnifier, they call it. If you hit the Win key, and the plus or minus, you can zoom in and out. So the Windows key and the minus may zoom out all the way to show you the whole screen again, the whole desktop again, where you might be able to find the rest of the controls.
But before you do all of that, because of the last thing you said, it sounds to me like you've set your Windows system to tablet mode.
Tablet mode.
Right. So what you do is you want to click the hi. How are you? Hi. I would like you to click the start button is what I'd actually like you to do.
Right.
I'm thinking tablet now, so I want to say tap, not click, but he's not on a tablet. So Click the start button.
Right.
Launch the settings app.
Yep.
Click on system.
This, okay.
And on the left side of the screen, scroll all the way down to the bottom and uncheck tablet mode.
Okay.
And that should, it might solve all your problems, as a matter of fact.
I'll give it a shot. I figure if I can't get it done after this, is there also a possibility that there's something wrong in registry?
It's certainly possible, but if you were fiddling around with settings,
yeah,
and you didn't write down what you were doing so you could undo it,
right.
Then it is very possible that you turned on tablet mode.
And there might be a key combination that turns it on.
It's one thing I haven't checked on. I kept fiddling, hoping I could solve it.
Yeah, been there.
Yeah, I didn't want to. I've taken my desktop to Dave almost a year ago, 8 months ago, and I had a lot of problems with registry, and he cleared that up fine.
Yeah. Well, you may have registry problems, but I'd start here. It's the simplest solution, and it certainly sounds like it would solve at least half your problems and maybe all of them.
Yeah, okay. I'll give that a shot. Thanks for your help, guys.
Absolutely. Have fun.
So tablet mode can be handy if you have a touchscreen.
Right.
But most laptops don't yet, so accidentally turning on touchscreen and tablet mode can be annoying.
Also, some laptops now have, they flip.
Yeah.
So you can turn it into a tablet-ish-like thing, and that turns off the keyboard so you're not accidentally hitting keys, and it turns on the all the tablet features. The problem is with some of them, because Windows 10 is in, and I hope you're all sitting down now. If you're driving, hold on to the steering wheel. Windows 10 is not perfect. Sometimes, I know. Unbelievable. When you unflip the tablet and turn it back into a laptop, sometimes tablet mode doesn't go off.
Yep.
And people get confused as to how suddenly, because they'll unflip it and close it because they just want to go away. Yep. Then they open it next time and it's in the wrong mode and they don't know how to handle that. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Gary from Greece again. Or is this a different Gary from Greece?
No, this is Andy.
Oh, this is Andy from, oh, it's my eyes. I am, I just looked at the first letter and I just went from there and it was a lowercase a and I thought it was a G and it's, I need better drugs. Go ahead, Andy, what's up?
I've been called far worse, no problem.
Yeah, by me, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, on occasion. couple quick things. The Raspberry Pi on a laptop.
Yeah.
I mean, from a geeky Radio Shack soldering iron kind of project thing, it sounds like fun.
Yeah.
From a practical standpoint, buy a Chromebook.
Well, exactly. I mean, yes. Here's the deal. If you've already got the laptop and you want to play, you know, $30 or $40 for a Raspberry Pi is a pretty good toy.
And I found a company called PiTop, which is a Raspberry Pi already in a laptop for like $100.
Yeah.
I mean, but otherwise, the nightmare of trying to get everything connected inside the box and keep it small enough and work right, I'd buy the Chromebook.
Well, right. No, absolutely. But, you know, if it's a hobby, if it's a toy, go for it. If it's if you're actually looking at a practical thing, buy a Chromebook. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I can, you know, there was a time in my life when that would sound like an interesting project and fun.
Yeah.
And now it's just, I'll buy the Chromebook.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, I'm with you. I don't do my own car maintenance anymore either.
Oh, that I gave up on that years ago. I don't have a computer that hooks to my car, and I don't want to.
You're right.
Quick, kind of background bureaucratic or functionary type questions here. When you get into the Jazz-O-Matic donations to support the station,
yeah,
does that continue indefinitely? You have to renew it.
It continues. Well, go ahead, Michael. You know this better than I do, but I believe it continues until you say no.
That I believe is correct. Yes.
Oh, okay, good. Then I don't have to do anything. It just keeps rolling. Cool.
Just keep on keeping on.
Good. Ignorance is bliss.
It has been for me.
Yeah, well, you talk about the dining out card. Does that get sent out every year?
Yes.
Okay, so then, all right. So
all members get that every year. So if you are, you know, if you're Jazz-O-Matic,
only at a certain level. I think.
Well, it's got to be at a certain level, but yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm coming up on the year, so I'll just, because they sent me out the card and I put it in a safe place, and it's so safe I can't find it.
That happened to me until I discovered it was in that safe place, ended up in my wife's purse.
Yeah, I keep mine on my wallet.
Yeah,
well, it never leaves. There. I already know that, but so I'm coming up on the year, so they'll send me out a new card, so I don't have to call and ask that. Okay, that's cool.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
gentlemen.
Andy. Yep. Bye-bye. Yeah, last time I said, well, you know, I'm going to join up again because I've lost my membership card. My wife got this sheepish look on her face, and I said, oh, apparently I didn't lose it. She said, you lost it, yes.
Nice.
All right, our next caller is Mark from Greece, New York. Hiya, Mark, what's up?
Good afternoon, guys. I'm going on a little over a month since I told you I got that Chromebook for my birthday.
Yep.
And absolutely loving it.
Excellent.
Did a little experimenting last week, not realizing what I did, but I wanted to check the beta channel.
The which channel?
The beta channel.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. Not realizing when you go back to the user channel,
you
have to power wash.
Yeah.
So I'm going, oh, you should have read more, you dummy. And then I go back in and I do it and sign back in and poof.
Everything's
even
there.
It power washed. 99.9% of everything was back.
Yep.
There was a couple little things that weren't a big deal that came right back in.
Yep.
You know, and I went, this is incredible.
Yeah, that's the thing I love about Chromebooks. The thing I love about buying a new Chromebook.
Mm-hmm.
You put in your username and your password, and then you just wait a couple of minutes, and everything from your old Chromebook shows up. Boom. Done.
That's beautiful. And I like that I can sign into both of my Gmail accounts on it.
Yep, yep.
So I can have two different experiences if I want to.
Yep.
Going from one account to the other.
Yep, yep.
Which was incredible. You know, I just thought this, the more I use it, the more I like it.
For, as I keep saying, for 90% of everybody, a Chromebook is all you need, and it does everything, and it does it so easily and so simply, and you get that little icon in the bottom that says update, and in fact, you can ignore it.
Right.
Shut your machine down. When you turn it on again next time, it'll update automatically.
That, it's wonderful, and I am only on my Windows PC when I need to run a program.
That's exactly right, and that's what I tell people. Determine what it is you do, and I'll bet you 90% of what you do, you can do on a Chromebook.
Exactly.
All right, thanks, Mark.
Yep.
Have fun. We're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes, Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 20 minutes after the hour, Soundbites, member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And light snoring here inside the studio, but we're trying to wake Steve up. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
There he is.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Jim from Arundhequoit on the line. What's up, Jim?
Hi, guys. Thanks a lot for all you do for people with information over the years. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
I have a question about, I have a HP fairly new top that has i5 Core 5 processor. I've got 12 gigs of RAM running Windows 10. And I've recently bought a Seagate Backup Plus Slim device that I want to use for my backups. And I was wondering about software. Now, there's Seagate supplies a dashboard, the Seagate dashboard that they use, which is really just a basic software for backing up on a regular basis. But I was looking at software for doing cloning the computer and doing disk imaging and that kind of stuff. Now, they also have available the Disk Wizard for Seagate. Are you guys familiar with this? And
a little bit, yeah.
What's your assessment of that? I know that Acronis, I think, actually supplies that product to them.
Yeah, it's a scaled-down version of their True Image software that only works on that Seagate drive.
Right.
Which is pretty cool. I just use that to upgrade the drive in my son's computer.
Right.
And as long as you keep using Seagate drives, that will work.
Right.
There is the Acronis True Image is a commercial program. There is a open-source free program called CloneZilla, which is very similar.
Right. Now, so that doesn't do regular incremental backups and stuff. That's strictly for cloning.
Right. Right. If you want to do incremental backups and stuff like that, there is a free program called Cobian Backup, C-O-B-I-A-N.
Okay.
And I think they're version 11 right now.
Full-scale kind of program will do incremental backups plus cloning and disk imaging and all that?
I believe it does dang near everything you'd ever want to do.
Yeah, because I, you know, instead of fooling around with a couple different programs and all that, it'd be nice to have one program that I could use for everything. It'd be great.
Yeah, you can do differentials. You can even limit the number of differentials. You can change your schedule types so that you can just say, you know, on the first Monday, do this.
Right. Now, basically, what I've been doing in the past is I have. You know, again, obviously, I'm turning my laptop on and off all the time, and I guess I don't save a lot of files, but so what I've been doing is basically when I run the run my cleanup programs and stuff. After that, then I do a backup. Then I just open up my program and let it do the incremental backup at that point instead of having it set up so that it automatically does it. Is that a decent strategy or what? I mean,
yes.
You know, it's probably not as comprehensive as a continuously running a backup program.
Well, right. But you may not need that depending on how you work. It doesn't sound like you do. The important thing is if you do an incremental, when you do a restore, you have to restore your last full and then the incremental.
Yes.
So my suggestion is at least once a week do a full.
Right. Okay. Right. So, yes, I got you. Yeah, just to set it up and let it run.
That's right. Set it up, let it run, go off and have, you know, a cup of coffee, breakfast, go to a movie.
Sounds good. Guys, thanks a lot for the, again, what you've been doing for all these years, and I appreciate the help.
Thank you. We appreciate you guys being out there for us. Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye, guys.
Have fun. And, of course, we most appreciate those of you who are members of Jazz 90.1, because that's what keeps us on the air. I do appreciate the people who have who are generously donating to keep the Soundbites website up and running, but that is separate from donations to the station, which keep the station on the air. So that's we love both of you people, both types of people.
Almost both of you people. No.
Yeah, some days it feels like both of you people. Oh, wait, well, since it is National Data Security Day, I should probably read this one. Tired of conventional passwords? So is Nuance Communications, a tech firm that is promoting the human voice as a way to secure user accounts. The company's voice biometric product is among the technologies that promises to replace traditional and often vulnerable password authentication systems, which can be easy to hack. That isn't the case. With Nuance's solution, the company claims, to determine if it's you or not, we are looking at over 100 different voice characteristics, said Brent Balanik, Nuance's director of product strategy. Oh, there's a venerable internet name, Bolt Baranek Newman. Were among the very first companies on the internet. They helped build it. And Brett Baranek, I wonder if he's any relation. The need to move beyond passwords hasn't been more urgent given that hackers are routinely finding ways to steal them. Last year, Yahoo, LinkedIn, and Dropbox all reported major data breaches involving account details such as email addresses and hashed passwords. With such information, a hacker can plunder through an email account like suspected Russian cyber spies did to the U.S. political figures in last year's election. However, security provider Nuance is trying to change the status quo. Already, banks and financial institutions have been deploying the company's voice biometric technology to verify user identities. The technology was first deployed in a call center back in 2001. Since then, it's been used in finance-related mobile apps and to secure PCs at a handful of organizations. Every human voice is unique. Factors like a person's larynx, the shape of the nasal cavity, and whether the subject is missing a tooth will all determine the way someone sounds. So if you set your biometric and then lose a tooth, you've got a problem. Nuance's technology has been built to analyze these differences to accurately determine who is who. Now, there is a problem, of course, if you've got laryngitis or some sort of throat-related illness or get a tooth knocked out or, you know, whatever. But generally speaking, it works. So then you would want to have two separate biometrics, so maybe the backup one would be a fingerprint or something. Anyway, would you use voice print as a password? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415, just like Mark did in Greece, New York. Hi, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Nick. I love the show. Long-time listener.
Love to hear that.
First, I'll say I regret not buying a Chromebook.
See?
But I'm trying to see if I can resolve it. I've got a Dell Windows 10 laptop that's less than a year old, and it gives me nothing but grief.
Yeah.
Can I easily, as a not a super geek techie person, can I set it up so I can put Chromium on it? So that my wife can just use it like a Chromebook, or do I have to bite the bullet and just get a Chromebook?
You wouldn't use Chromium. You would use Neverware's products. Neverware has a program called Cloud Ready. Yeah, okay. That's the one you would use. But so my question here, the question we have to ask is, can you set up Neverware to dual boot?
And I don't know the answer to that, but luckily...
I mean, I'd even be willing to overwrite what's on there because it just, it's never acted right. I regret installing Windows 10 because it wasn't a Windows 10 computer when I bought it, but I did it during that free upgrade.
Okay, two things. Certainly, you can simply replace what you have with Cloud Ready. That should work just particularly a new laptop. You want to go to their website, and Steve is putting up a link, I think, to the website that will give you the address, and then you one of the things on that site is a list of the supported desktops, I'm sure, desktop laptop computers.
Okay.
And I'm sure that a year-old Dell is on that list.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's true. But you will be able to set it up as dual boot. So once you've checked the hardware compatibility, then you want to create the installer. There's a whole list of installation notes. If you go to guide.neverware.com and to the installation directory, you'll see detailed installation instructions for dual boot as well as standalone. One thing you can do is actually create a USB stick,
right,
and boot from that to test things out, see how you like it. Now, that's going to be slightly slower because installing a rather reading from a USB drive is generally slower than reading from a hard drive.
Right.
But you'll get a feel for how it works.
And it's much faster than it would have been from CD or DVD, which is the way we used to do it.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So yeah, you can absolutely dual boot it. You can replace what's there. You can do whatever makes you happy. But my suggestion would be put it on a USB stick and run from that for a little bit to see that you're happy with what you see and how it works and yada, yada, yada.
Okay.
And you should be on your way. I recommend that for everybody with an old laptop that they don't feel is running, you know, either can't run Windows 10 or whatever the reason. Certainly for somebody who regrets their decision for Windows, at the very least being able to dual boot means that you have a laptop that you're now happy with, and if you ever really need to run Windows, you still can.
And it was, you said it was Guide, like D-I-E-D, .neverware.com?
No, Guide, as in,
guide.
You know, the Indian Guide or Girl Guides or the Boy Scout Guide.
Fantastic.
Right.
Thanks so much, guys.
Yeah, thank you. I think Steve has put up a link to it already.
And I put it out to the model finder, too. So you can put in the computer model you have, and it will tell you if it'll work or not.
There you go. Yeah, the Neverware started, when they started out, that model guide was very sparse.
Yep.
Although it worked on every machine I've ever put it on, it certainly wasn't supported, and sometimes I had to muck about to make it work. But that list has been growing and growing and growing as time goes on. It's kind of great. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Tim from Webster, New York. Hiya, Tim. What's up?
Yeah, hi, guys. Regarding the backups, what I've always done is I have, like, two physical locations, like a thumb drive and an external hard drive to back up my most important stuff. And I'm looking into, like, cloud-type services, but I've never understood these full system backups. Specifically, what I wanted to know is how are these backups dealt with if there is an infection, like malware or something that's happened, how the backups, I'm assuming, could be infected as well. So I was wondering how that whole thing's handled, and I'll get off the phone and let you answer. Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks, Tim. Here's the deal with backups in general. They back up what's on your hard drive. So if your hard drive is infected, your backup is infected. Now, that said, the way you fix that is in whatever setup you have that allows you to back up, say, at 2 a.m. At 1 a.m., you run a full diagnostic, full scan with your antivirus software and your anti-malware software and everything else. The basic idea being clean your machine before you back it up. Some of the higher-end backup systems also run their own checks. You can pay extra for that. And they will do it for you, but really you should be very careful. That's one of the reasons that I have an issue with cloning hard drives. Because if the thing that killed you and necessitated restoring that clone is a registry issue. It is likely that registry issue built up over time, and it is likely you backed it up. So that's the problem I have with cloning Windows 10. Now, that said, you don't have that issue with a Mac or with Linux, or I suppose with a Chromebook, although you don't need to back up a Chromebook. But so, yeah, I agree that if you have a virus on your computer, you will have that same virus in your backup. So you want to be sure before you do the backup to clean your machine.
And many backup services will call that versioning. So, you know, right, the 2 a.m. version is infected, so let's restore the 1 a.m. version. Some program, generally an incremental backup, will backup only changes, but you want to either see something called versioning or backup history. So it keeps the old versions of the file so you can back up to last week or last month. Apple's Time Machine will do that built into the Macs. Many of the online services will do that as well. Just check to see which payment level you need to be at to get that service.
Right, right. But they're all doable. All right. Our next caller is Matt from Rochester, New York. Hi, Matt. What's up?
Hi, guys. I wonder if you could give me some instruction on how to lock down my iPad, and I've got an LG phone that I use strictly on Wi-Fi, and I wonder, is there a way to lock that down so I don't lose all my information?
Well, generally, that's two different issues.
Right.
You lock your iPad so that someone can't come along and steal it and get to your files. And you lock the iPad with a passcode lock in settings, general passcode.
And what I was wondering is, if I'm out someplace and I'm using their Wi-Fi, could somebody get in and get my passwords and all that?
It's possible that someone could read the Wi-Fi, and if you're typing a password into a website, they could read that password, yes.
And if I'm not, they can't get into it?
Right. So what you want to do when you're at a open Wi-Fi or a public Wi-Fi hotspot, make sure it's encrypted, that you have to ask for a password, which helps that other people can't get into the data either because it's encrypted. And whenever you're surfing the web, if you're going to a banking website or to Amazon or somewhere where you're typing passwords in, make sure that website is encrypted and has the little padlock icon in the address bar. Then the data is encrypted on your iPad before it goes out over the network. And so that helps keep that encryption, that information safe.
Same with the phone?
No, the phone will be a little different, and you want two things there. One is called Lookout Mobile Security.
And they do have an iPad version, too, but it can't do as much because the iPad has more security built in to prevent applications from seeing other people, the other data from other applications.
Right, and Lookout will do a whole bunch of things. It'll back your machine up, and it'll check to see if there are viruses in it. It has all kinds of features. Some of them you pay for, but it does do all of that stuff.
Will that work on my LG phone?
Yes, it will work on any Android phone.
And where can I find that?
In the App Store. In the Google Play Store, look for Lookout Mobile Security.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Now, hold on. There's one more thing you can do. That is for the backup of the system. But in addition, there is a feature in your phone called Smart Lock.
Oh.
And what Smart Lock does is it lets you say, I have certain trusted devices or trusted places, or in fact, the new version has trusted face. So what I have set my phone to do, for example, is if it is in range of my watch, it unlocks. So if you were to steal my phone and get it more than, say, 10 feet away from me, it would lock because it's now no longer in range of the trusted device that unlocks it.
Okay.
At home or with my wife's phone, because she doesn't have a watch, I've set it so that if she's on home Wi-Fi, it's unlocked, but when she leaves the house, it's locked.
Oh, okay.
And that's in trusted places in your settings.
Okay.
All right.
That helps. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. We've got to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes. Steve Ray, Michael Oden, Nick Francesco, you, 43 minutes after the hour, Soundbites, Member Supported Jazz 9.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Roden.
And at 46 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about Lookout. It's an amazing program. The free version does lots and lots of stuff. The paid version, I personally believe, is well worth it. And it's not expensive, but it's I think well worth it because you get a lot more features and I think it's Lookout Mobile. It's called Lookout Mobile Security. You get a lot more features and a lot of pretty cool stuff. So,
and they do have iOS versions that do a lot of what the Android versions do, but not everything because of the locking down Apple has already done. One of the things we're talking about between the break here is it will report if any accounts you use have been breached by another company. So it will say that your Yahoo email got breached, which is kind of nice. So you don't have to go and find out yourself. You get a little message that pops up and tells
you. And so any of the apps on your system, it'll monitor them as well. So it's pretty cool. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Patrick from Batavia, New York. Hi, Patrick. What's up?
Hi, guys. I just want to tell you about great success I had with a suggestion you had a few weeks ago about this Revo program.
Oh, yeah.
I had a piece of software that was giving me problems, and when I Googled the way to deal with it, they said, well, in the system registry, you could do bin, 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 and I thought,
yeah,
danger, danger.
Yep.
So what basically was happening is when you uninstalled it, it didn't uninstall it completely. So I downloaded the Revo, took it all out, and I realized the idea of cleaning the registry when you uninstall programs. Which leads to my question is, what about programs in the past that I have uninstalled? Now, of course, there's a owner's manual, which you could read if you wanted to, or you could just ask Nick.
So what Patrick is talking about is a program called Revo Uninstaller. What it does is... when you install something in Windows, it puts a bunch of junk in the registry. The registry's stupidest idea anybody has ever had in the history of computers.
We want to find who thought of the registry, go back in time, and stop them.
And slap them silly. So what happens is it puts all this junk in the registry. When you uninstall a program, all Windows does is put a note in the registry, essentially, that says, yeah, this is useless information now. Ignore it. Over time, your registry gets flipping enormous because you've got a bunch of junk in there you don't need anymore, which increases boot up time, which increases runtime for any program. And so the question becomes, how do you get rid of that stuff? And so what Patrick is asking is, you can certainly, once you've put Revo Uninstaller on your machine, which, by the way, you should do, that should be the first program to add to any Windows system. Which would answer his question. But it will remove, you can do a, what do they call it? It's a report. I don't. They have a name for it, and I don't remember what it is. But they have a report which will show you all the useless cruft in the registry. And so, if you're careful and you don't want to just close your eyes and point, you want to pay attention to each thing. But you can carefully remove a bunch of junk from the registry using Revo.
And it will try to uninstall the programs that you installed before Revo. It can't do quite as good a job because it wasn't watching the install, but it does a pretty good job of cleaning it out after the fact.
It also depends on the program, because any program that it knows about, it knows where the registry stuff goes, and it can remove that. So really, it's programs that were installed before it was installed that are not in its database that you have some issues with.
So it sounds like there's no simple fix my computer, please.
Well, start Revo, over. Yeah, I'll start over.
Well, no, you said simple, yeah.
Yeah, simple. Simple is run Revo, and again, do that complete, clean it out completely, being very careful about what you do, and then see how well it's running after that.
Okay. Oh, yeah, and my wife told me something she very interesting. She heard about computer security issues, about people calling you up, and what they do is when you answer the phone, they say, "Can you hear me?" And, of course, when you say, "Can you hear me?" you start speaking a little louder and clearer.
Yep.
And what they're doing is getting your voice recorded so that they can use it for nefarious purposes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so now... the guy that says, "Can you hear me now?" you might want to hang up on him.
Yep. When I get
at the Easter, you're gonna have trouble.
They're stealing your voice now.
They're stealing my voice right now. I'm on the air, so everybody's got my voice.
My voice is my passport. Verify me.
Right. Exactly.
Actually, Nick, when you walk into a room, people don't even have to see you because they just hear your voice and say, "Hey, there's Nick."
That is, I find it difficult to hide anywhere. What I've done now is when I get a phone call from, like, Nebraska, I don't have any friends in Nebraska. If I get a phone call from somewhere like Nebraska, I answer the phone saying, "Thanks for calling Soundbites. What's your question? You're on the air."
There you go.
And I get this
thing. I noticed that another possible convert to the Chromebook might want to be reminded that we meet this Thursday.
Oh, that's right. It's going to be the start of the month. Holy moly.
I give the details, and I will fade into... the other thing I noticed you didn't really talk about is the blizzard of 77, which really hit the Buffalo area, but didn't touch Rochester much. That was 40 years ago today.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Non-news, right?
Yeah. Well, no, that's
some places, but not where you are.
That's well. It hit a lot of people. It hit us. It hit me. I was. I had my electric lines were in our pond. Live in our pond. And I called our genie and said, our lines are down and we need somebody to come and take care of them right now because they're frozen into the pond. And he said, "Well, that's not a problem because there's no electricity." And I said, "Well, no, my lights are on. My refrigerator is running. My computer is running. There is electricity in my home at this moment, so it's got to be running through my pond. You really need to send somebody." And they said, "That can't be. There's no electricity in there." I said, "Sir, I'm not lying to you. I'm looking at my lights." So when they finally sent somebody like 3 days later, the guy starts screaming at me, "Oh, my God, you have live electrical lines in your pond. Why didn't you call?" I thought, there's no alternative to these guys. I'm stuck with them.
Talk to a bureaucrat or somebody with what they think is correct information, and they don't need to know your reality because they say, "According to my records, you're out. You're in."
That's exactly right.
No. Okay.
All right. Thanks. For those of you who would like to know about the various local user groups, at the Soundbites homepage in the banner near the top, it says Rochester Area User Groups, and it lists Apple Cider, the Linux User Group of Rochester, the Rochester Computer Society, and Rochester Googles. And so you can get some information about that. And we meet the first Thursday of every month at St. John Meadows at 7 o'clock in Briarwood. If you would like your group to be on that list, send me an email and we'll get that to happen. And we're done for another week. I want to thank Steve Ray. I want to thank Michael Oden. who has for 2 weeks provided amazing and wonderful service to us and kept us on the straight and narrow. But he'll be here for another couple hours while he does the same thing for George, who will be in to play the best German music you'll hear all week. We will be back to see you next week with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites, and the truly great and truly honored to be member-supported by you, Jazz 90.1. We will see you in 166 hours.